So we started talking, so onto the lecture, we started talking about fluids and how you can derive fluid equations from Boltzmann equations. So any questions that are lingering from last time? So we basically argue that as long as you have efficient collisions, then you can take some moments of, but then you have some conservation laws, you can take some moments of the Boltzmann equation, and those moments are in fact independent of the details of the collision and lead to fluid equations. So the fluid equations, you have the relativistic version and non-relativistic version. So I promised to write a relativistic version for you. So, so there's a non-relativistic. So this is what we derived last week. Sorry, last lecture on Tuesday. This is the continuity. There is the energy conservation, which is this guy, plus epsilon, plus divergence of F equal to zero, where F is the heat flux, or sorry, F is the energy flux. I don't have an expression for it somewhere. Where did you go? F is 1/2 of rho US squared plus epsilon plus P times U. And then I wanted to leave room. So let me just put it down here. So F is 1/2 of rho US squared plus epsilon plus P U. And then last one is the momentum conservation, which is d by dt of rho ui is minus dtij. Let me just put this all of this downstairs. By dxj, where tij is Tij is rho ui uj plus plus something p delta ij. Okay. So this was one way of writing it, and I think you could plug these in here, and they might look a little bit different. So this was energy conservation. This is momentum conservation. And this is number conservation. Now there's a relativistic version of this that they didn't write, but it's easy to derive. And in some sense, it's actually more concise. So I have it somewhere here. So you can define particle current, which is J mu, which is D3P, where E of P, P mu, F of X and P. And then there is the energy momentum tensor, which is C squared integral D3P over E of P, P mu, P nu, F of X and P. So, and this guy, in fact, the components of this is are Tij and F. So Tij would be basically mu and nu being the spatial component. T0i is this guy, is F. In the non-relativistic limit. So there are some non-relativistic approximations that are made here. And And in fact, these two equations, energy conservation and momentum conservation, can be combined to get, in the relativistic case, can be combined into one equation. I mean, the number doesn't change, but they can all be written in one concise form, which is this guy, or I guess it's just this. So this is a derivative of T mu nu with respect to nu. And I mean, you're all familiar with this convention. This is just to say that d of t mu nu by d of x nu is equal to 0. And x nu, x 0 is time, xi is our spatial coordinates, xi. So these two combine to this to give this guy, or in other words, the components of this, the 0 component and the I components, in the relativistic limit become these two equations, the momentum conservation and energy conservation equation. And then this other equation, the number conservation, can be written easily as j mu mu is equal to 0, right? Yes. Right. This is all in flat space, of course. In curve space, this just become covariant derivative. So for those of you who be interested to do this in, say, in general relativity or general space time. So all of these trivially translate to curve space, all these equations. These expressions would be the same, and these guys would just be covariant derivatives instead of. So this is, right. So this is generally true, okay? So this is these are just moments of Boltzmann equation. Now, if you want to take the fluid limit, then the question is what happens? So the fluid limit, even that is actually straightforward. So the fluid limit is just, J mu is just the fluid. There isn't anything particular about J mu. You could write J mu as nu mu, okay, and then t mu nu being rho plus p, u mu u nu plus p g mu nu. You see, they more or less look like what you've got here. I mean, I didn't write an expression for j here, but j would be just the current, which is something like this. T mu nu. So this is a perfect fluid case. However, if you want to include the viscous corrections, then that's not very well defined in the relativistic case. So there is a simple way of introducing viscous corrections that's self-consistent relativistically. And in some sense, the idea is that viscous corrections are not supposed to be self-consistent. They are, first terms in some expansion, in some approximation. But when you truncate that expansion, you don't have a self-consistent system anymore. In non-relativistic fluid mechanics, you can get away with it in some situations. But in relativistic case, you do see inconsistencies. The inconsistencies don't show up all the time, but they are there because if you do the truncation, the system is not causal, for example. So this is the perfect fluid case, which is analogous to what I have here for the fluid case. So here there is no viscous corrections. Okay, so these are this is a relativistic case, and which in some sense it's more concise because you can compactify these equations to one equation. Of course, they have the same content. One other thing you notice is this particular form that appears, d3p divided by e of p. So this doesn't look very covariant, but in fact, it turns out that this combination is invariant under Lorentz transformation. So this is a covariant expression under, if you do a Lorentz transformation or general coordinate transformation. So energy, of course, changes, the momentum changes, but this integral doesn't change. This combination d3p over e doesn't change. Right. Okay, good. Any questions? So then let's go back to our viscous corrections that we were discussing last time, and to the non-relativistic case where, I mean, fluid mechanics is in some sense easier. I guess, no, it was, I've done 13, lecture 14, that's the one. Come on. Okay, so let's write down our viscous equations again. So these were perfect fluid cases, but I can rewrite this plus the viscous corrections, which remember I introduced as gradient expansions, gradient terms added to those expressions for heat flux, for F, or sorry, for energy flux, and for a momentum, the energy momentum or a stress tensor. So the way it looks like was rho dv by dt equals minus grad p plus eta Laplacian of v zeta plus 1/3 of eta grad divergence of v. And d rho by dt plus rho divergence of v equals 0. And then there was the, so this d by dt, remember the definition, it was a covariant derivative, co-moving derivative. You move with the fluid, take the derivative. And then the last one is the energy conservation. Which says entropy is conserved unless there's heat transfer or heat flux or viscous heating, which was this guy. And I mean, I'm sure you can look up these definitions in your notes if you got them. So this S was entropy per unit mass. Entropy per unit mass. And this is, if there is no dissipative effect, entropy should be conserved. Dissipative effects lead to exchange of energy between neighboring co-moving cells. So then you have the second law of thermodynamics. So TdS is d plus PdV, basically. And right, so the d plus, and basically the energy exchange is through these guys. Basically, this is the heat flux, basically, which causes energy exchange between neighboring cells. And this is the viscous heating, which converts the kinetic energy to thermal energy. Okay, so, right, I think I mentioned this. This is heat flux. And this is viscous heating. So this is responsible for making the temperature uniform in a medium. Right? If you have gradients of temperature, this term causes the temperature to change, to change until it's uniform everywhere. Right, the P is pressure. I think everywhere here the P is pressure. I guess I didn't add the gravitational acceleration, but I mean that would be, if you had that, you would also add that in here as well. Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay, so I should. Okay, so let's put it this way. Right, P is pressure everywhere, except where it's not, I guess. Yeah, I think I should have made it bigger. Yeah, so here, right, so here P is momentum. Sorry about that. Pressure is a scalar. Well, if it's not a perfect fluid, so in the fluid limit, pressure is a scalar, you could add, so the viscous corrections can give you an isotropic stress. You wouldn't call them pressure. I think some people would call them an isotropic pressure, but in the technical sense, it's not pressure. These are corrections, basically, to the fluid stress tensor. Right. I mean, it's a matter of definition, really. So these coefficients, these three coefficients, these are, as I said, these are transport coefficients. This guy, kappa, eta, and zeta. And these are basically terms in a Taylor expansion. And these are the first terms that appear, or the first coefficients of a Taylor expansion of these guys, these fluxes, in terms of gradients. And there you could have, there's an infinite number of them, and people do compute them if they're interested. Usually the first ones are the ones that are the most important. If all the other ones become important, then you think that the Taylor expansion is not, or the gradient expansion is not really valid anymore. But these first ones are important because there's some things that don't happen if these guys aren't there. For example, energy is conserved, the kinetic energy is conserved if these guys aren't there, because your, well, I guess kinetic energy is always conserved, but you don't transfer. Let's see, actually, is that true? But so let's put it that way. Entropy is conserved if these guys aren't there, so because this vanishes. So if you wanted to see the system reaching thermal equilibrium, you need to have at least the leading viscous terms. Otherwise, the system never reaches thermal equilibrium. Entropy is always conserved, right? Never increases. So you can actually calculate these guys by perturbing. So the idea is that the way you calculate these is you look at this phase space distribution. It's the thermal distribution that I wrote last time. It's basically the Boltzmann distribution plus some corrections. And these corrections, the coefficients of that go as kappa, eta, and zeta, these transport coefficients, these transport coefficients. And you can actually calculate them in for particular collisional models. So, and as you actually have seen it, for example, in the case of harder spheres, if you imagine your particles are just harder spheres that they collide only when they touch each other, then you get kappa is 75, square root of 2 pi over 3, divided by 256, thermal velocity divided by sigma, where sigma is the cross section. You don't have sigma anywhere else. So this is sigma is cross section of the spheres. And V thermal is, of course, the square root of kT over m. And then eta is 4m over 15 times kappa. And then zeta is equal to 0. This is an example. So how do you calculate this? So the formal way to calculate this is to just basically solve Boltzmann equation order by order. I guess I don't have the Boltzmann equation here, but the idea would be that basically you start with this guy. You start with by ignoring delta F that you have thermal distribution, you plug it into Boltzmann equation, and then find the leading corrections basically to this order by order in the. So the idea would be that the collisions would be big. So let's see. I actually haven't done this in a while. So let's see whether we can reproduce this. So the idea would be that, so you have this equation, df by dt plus v dot grad f plus the minus grad u, let's say, dot df by dp. This is equal to 0. Oh, sorry, this is equal to c of f. So if you had a completely uniform, if there is no spatial dependence, then the exact solution would be just a thermal. Thermal solution will exactly satisfy this, because for a thermal distribution, this is zero, as we discussed before. And then there is no gradient. If you just have the, assume there's no gradient, this would be zero. And then there is no force. Let's say it's a uniform medium. So grad U would be zero. And then so df by dt would be zero. So everything would be consistent. So if you have a uniform f, there's no time dependence, no spatial dependence, just the thermal distribution, everything would be zero. So then the next thing you would do is that you assume that there is some small spatial dependence, and you try to solve this perturbatively. So let's see, in the gradient expansion, the idea would be that you have a delta F, and I believe that, yeah, so let's see how you do it. You try to basically solve this equation. So you said F is, so you put, instead of F here, you put F F thermal plus delta F. And the same here, F thermal plus delta F here. So in the gradient expansion, so these are small, right? These are their time derivatives and spatial derivatives would be small. So you don't have to put delta F there. So you just put that thermal here. And this guy would be just delta C by delta F times delta F thermal. Because F thermal itself, C is zero for it. So the leading term would be this guy. Of course, but this is going to be an integral equation because these guys, if you remember, this had the integrals in it. So the trick is basically to find, so the left-hand side, you know, is just the gradients of the thermal guy. And then the trick would be to just try to solve this integral equation. But then there is a way, there are ways to do this. If you make ansatz for this delta F should depend on gradients. But the point is that this guy depends on the gradients of this F thermal. In this F thermal, remember, F thermal is just number density times e to the minus e minus u dot p divided by temperature. So gradient of F thermal depends on gradient of n, gradient of the velocity, gradient of the temperature. So that's how you do it formally. And that, this is what you get. Roughly, it is an easy way to do this without too much rigor, but gives you basically where those orders of magnitude come from, or where those formula up to order one coefficients come from. And that's just by simple arguments. You might have seen it in your, I guess, elementary physics classes. So the idea would be that you have basically particles that are moving across the surface, and you want to calculate, so if there's some velocity here, this is u. Fluid is moving with some velocity, then you want to calculate the, I guess in this case, let's calculate not the velocity, but the heat transport coefficient. So the temperature here is T x plus lambda, which is T of x plus dT by dx, or let's call it z plus lambda. Z. Lambda. And lambda is the mean free path. Let's say the particles between two collisions, they travel lambda, distance lambda. dT by dz is gradient of temperature in this direction. And so the temperature up here is T of z plus lambda. Down here is T of z. And the heat transport is just basically how much energy from one side goes to the other side, because these guys have different amount of different temperatures. So from one collision to the next, the guys that come from this side to this side have higher energy, let's say, if this gradient is negative. The guy, on average, the guys that could go from this side to that side, they have lower energy. So there will be some energy exchange. That depends on the difference in the temperature, or the gradient of temperature. So the difference in temperature is the gradient of temperature times the distance. The distance is of order the mean free path, which is 1 over n sigma. Right? And if you just calculate that, then delta E divided by delta T, the exchange of energy per unit time, per unit area, this is roughly, it's roughly the density times the thermal velocity times the difference in temperature, because so the difference in temperature, this is delta T. That would be a order of the difference in energy between the guys that come from this side to this side and guys that come from this side to that side, which is NV thermal, and delta T is lambda, which is 1 over N sigma, times dT by dZ. So N's cancel. And so this is what you find, that this would be the energy flux. Right? This is what you called F, or but these are the corrections to the F, let's say. F heat flux. So the F that we had here was just the energy flux, but then the corrections to this, remember, when does kappa gradient of T? I think there's a minus sign as well. So these are the heat flux. And then of course there were corrections here, as viscous terms that were a bit longer. This when that sigma ij and divergence of V. Right. So this is how you get this form, right? So heat flux now is V thermal divided by sigma times dT by dZ up to factors of order unity. So this says that kappa is of order V thermal divided by sigma, which is what we have up there, right? Oh, sorry. Yes, we have up there. So this is the actual numerical coefficient. V thermal divided by sigma up to some order of one factor. And you could do a similar calculation, but instead of a velocity gradient, you have instead of a temperature gradient, you could have a velocity gradient. And then you can find the momentum transfer. That would be these terms. So the interesting thing about this term is that this is diagonal in the rest frame, right? So I guess this came up before. And if you go to the rest frame of the fluid, ui uj is zero. So this guy is diagonal. So the only momentum transfer that happens is perpendicular to the surface because this guy is diagonal. Because so remember, tij is the momentum flux, right? If you multiply this by an area element, then it gives you the momentum flux across the surface. The fact that it's diagonal, it tells you that momentum flux is only is perpendicular to the surface. There is no momentum flux across or parallel to the surface, but that's only the perfect fluid case. So the viscous terms, they could actually give you momentum flux that's parallel to the surface, and that's what viscosity is, right? So if you have a gradient of velocity from one side to the next, then there could be basically one side, the side that's going faster, could drag the side that's going slower. So that's how you can calculate this, at least at an approximate level. So when you do this, you find basically a similar cancellation, and you find this relationship. This up to factors of order unity. And I think the main thing is this should be for a monoatomic or single atomic gas. If it's not single atomic gas, then energy, this relationship is only valid for single. So let's see. Right. So eta equals 4m kappa over 15, this is only for single atomic gas. Single atomic or monatomic gas. The reason for that is eta depends on tells you about the momentum transfer, so it depends on the bulk velocity of everything. Kappa depends on the heat transfer, which is the, includes the internal energy. And so if you don't have monatomic gas, if you have molecules, for example, then it changes kappa, but it doesn't change eta. Okay. So this is independent of the cross section. That's the interesting, important thing, is that for any cross section, this should be valid, as long as you talk about monatomic gas. Okay, any questions so far? So one thing you notice is that, and it's a little bit counterintuitive, is sigma is, so kappa goes to zero if sigma goes to infinity, right? I guess by now it shouldn't be very counterintuitive. But the point is that if sigma goes to infinity, if you have infinite cross-section, collisions happen very fast, lambda goes to zero, and also this transport coefficients, they all go to zero. And that's the point, right? If you have very efficient collisions, then you have a perfect fluid. You don't have to worry about viscous and heat transfer effect. Right? So it is counterintuitive, but this follows from the logic that we have all the way through, that efficient collisions means negligible dissipation effects, right? So basically, if lambda goes to zero, all of these go to zero. And one thing to have in mind is that basically lambda is the scale at which you have to worry about viscous effect. So lambda is the mean free path of collisions. If you're talking, so roughly speaking, this is not an exact statement, but roughly speaking, on the scales that are much bigger than mean free path of collisions, you could assume you have a perfect fluid. Okay. So to do this a little bit more formally, we define the quantity that's known as Reynolds number. So the question is, when can we ignore viscosity? And as I gave you the rough criterion, but in fact, it does depend on other things. It doesn't just depend on the size, it also depends on the velocity of the system, as it turns out. So do you remember the equation we had, which is up there? The Navier-Stokes equation. So you have inertial force, and then you have the viscous force. And the Reynolds number is defined as, before I go on, is there any question so far? Nope? Everything is crystal clear, right? Crystal clear. So when can we ignore viscosity? So historically, there is this so-called Reynolds number, or RE, that's defined as the ratio of inertial force, or roughly the ratio of inertial force, which is, of course, you could take any of those any of those terms, but the one that's historically has been used is rho v dot grad v. Right. So this is in that equation up there. Where did this hockey stick up? This rho dv by dt, remember the definition of dv by dt is the partial by partiality plus v dot grad or v dot d by dx. So this rho times v dot d by dx of v, that's a term that appears on the left hand side in the perfect fluid case. So this is the inertial force. Let me call it inertial force. It's not really a force. It's inertial acceleration, really. Divided by the viscous force, which is eta Laplacian of B. Force. Or viscous, well, I guess I should call it force because it's multiplied by the density. An acceleration, you have to divide by the mass to get an acceleration. So without the rho, it would be just acceleration. So this ratio, you can imagine if it's much bigger than one, then, so this is approximately defined. Let me put an approximation here. I'm going to write the exact definition in a minute, in a second. But so if this is big, then you can imagine that this viscous force is small. That means eta is small, so you can ignore viscous effect. If this is small, then the viscous effects are important. So of course, this depends on these gradients. A more convenient definition, which is not as exact, but it's kind of what's used, is instead of gradient, you assume gradients of order 1 over the size of the system. So you have, instead of rho v dot grad v, you write something like rho v squared divided by L, assuming that gradients of order 1 over L. And then this guy is eta v divided by L squared. So this gives you rho v L divided by eta. And it turns out that with this number, with this definition, because there is some arbitrariness in what you call L if you have some general flow, but roughly speaking, what happens is that if RE is much bigger than 1,000, turns out you can ignore viscosity. Or the effect of viscosity is not important. If it becomes of order 1,000 or smaller, then viscosity is important. And this depends on the situation, but this is the rough number. So then depending on the situation, it could be 10,000, it could be a million, or it could be like a few hundred.
So V
is some sort of typical velocity and L of typical size of the system, right? And
is that typical size of the interaction?
Well, so remember what happened here. So we replace gradients by 1 over L, right? So basically the definition of L would be, in some sense, if you have grad V, it should be of order V divided by L. So this is the definition of L. So if you have a big system, let's say, in principle, if you have a small system, but then the gradient is zero, then L would be infinite, even though. So it's really the size of the gradient that fixes the size of the system. I mean, the idea would be that roughly the size of the system fits the size of gradient, but you can have a special situations where they are very different from each other.
So yeah, okay, so basically the scale.
Right, exactly. It's a scale in which V changes by order 1, basically. Okay, good questions? So, let's see. So this is the definition, and then, so let me just write, what else should I say? So, and then if the viscosity is important, the effect, as I mentioned, is to increase the entropy. So, so what you get is, so the entropy by dt, where entropy is defined as integral d3x rho s, where this s was entropy per unit mass. This is total entropy, right? In some co-moving region, this goes as integral kappa grad log t squared plus eta divided by 2t sigma ij squared. Remember this sigma ij, this was a transverse part of divergence of velocity. Dibj plus djvi minus 1/3 of divergence of the delta ij. This is sigma ij. And then plus zeta over t divergence of v squared. Plus surface terms. This is d3x the surface terms. So notice that this, what's special about one of the properties of the way these gradient terms appear is that they always tend to increase the entropy as long as these are positive coefficients. For example, I mean, this tells you the signs of kappa, eta, and zeta must be positive if you want entropy to increase, which basically says, for example, if kappa is positive, that means heat goes from the hotter place to the colder place. That's what you expect from the second law of thermodynamics, right? So the point is that this is always positive as long as you ignore the surface terms. Of course, that means that for a closed system, entropy should always increase with time due to these terms. Okay, and so what this means is that the role of these viscous terms, so when this viscosity becomes important for a small Reynolds number, the role, as I was saying, is to maximize the entropy, and by that it means that it should turn macroscopic degrees of freedom to microscopic degrees of freedom. Or convert energy that's in the bulk motion into thermal motion, which is random motions of atoms or molecules. So that's the role of the viscous terms. Right. So that means that it's these terms turn bulk gradients, really, into microscopic motion. Either gradients in temperature or gradients in velocity. Eventually, when this entropy is maximized, they should go to zero. So the maximum entropy, this is a maximum entropy situation, is where the gradients vanish. Okay. Let's see. So one interesting thing is, I should mention this. So in the case that Reynolds number is bigger than large, usually, not always, but in most cases, this leads to instabilities. I don't know, I guess you cannot read this very well. But so in most cases, this leads to instabilities. And what that means is that you might start from you may fine tune your flow, say in a pipe or in a river or anywhere you can imagine, or in some astrophysical situation. And you fine tune velocity to be very, very uniform. A small gradients. Of course, if the gradients of a small system is big, gradient of the small system is big, so Reynolds number is big. But that means that in most of these, this statement, and this is something that you can actually check in simple situations, most cases you find instabilities. And that means that even you start with a uniform or laminar flow, it quickly develops instabilities that leads to turbulence. Right. So that's the significance of Reynolds number. And so you can ask a question that if you, for example, if you have a pipe that carries water, when can you assume it's a laminar flow and where can I assume it's turbulence? And it has to do with the size of the pipe. Basically, if you know the viscosity of water, the density of water, and the velocity through the pipe, then you calculate the Reynolds. And then if you know the size of the pipe, you calculate Reynolds number. If Reynolds number is big, then you expect turbulent flow. If it's small, then you don't generate turbulence. So that's the idea. And the idea mainly is that basically if you don't have viscous effects, you have conservation laws, right? Entropy is conserved. So whenever you have something that's conserved, then it's very close to being unstable, right? Because conservation is something, the time derivative of something is zero, right? So you could imagine then if you change it a little bit, then it could go either be unstable or stable. And this it turns out that generally there are some modes that are that decay, but some modes that grow if you are in this, basically, in the regime where you have something that's conserved. Now, when Reynolds number becomes small, then viscous effects kick in. So you don't have conservation. Basically, energy, that is the bulk energy, generically decays. Because as I said, you want to convert the bulk energy or bulk gradients into microscopic motion. So these instabilities usually go away. The instabilities that are present for large Reynolds numbers, if you kick up this eta, eventually they all go away because they all basically the viscosity damps everything. So what you know, I mean, another way of putting it is that the viscosity wants to tell. So instabilities want to increase the gradients because that's what they do. They have a small perturbations grow and become big, so the gradient terms become big. But then the viscosity wants to do the opposite. Right? It wants to turn bulk gradients into microscopic motion. So there's always a competition. And when eta is big, then when viscosity is big, then it wins and it basically gets rid of all the instabilities.
So you're saying that it's easier to describe fluid if you use the viscosity?
If it is.
If it has viscosity?
Right, exactly. So large viscosity means you have laminar flow, simple, in a sense that instabilities don't develop. They're all damped or suppressed. If you have, you could have complicated situations where actually viscosity leads to secondary instabilities, but those would be a different type of instability. So the fast instabilities, they are the ones that happen for large Reynolds number. Absolutely, yeah. So, yes, we have it here. Well, I guess here it's a function of temperature and cross-section. So in this case, it's not for a simple, it's a function of temperature, so that's certainly one thing it can do. But then it can be a function of density. I'm pretty sure it can be. It just depends on the type of interactions that you have. So these equations, these criteria are usually good for incompressible systems where density doesn't change very much. And if it does, then things get more complicated. And I think I'm gonna mention them, not in too much details. But yeah, even those equations are only good for incompressible because otherwise you would have gradients of viscosity appearing there. Remember why we would, because Tij, these viscous terms appear here, but then I have to take the gradient of divergence of these. So here I assume that eta is constant, so that there is no gradient of viscosity that appears there. Okay. So let's see. So I want to talk about vorticity and about sound waves, and that's basically it. See how much? Yeah, I have 20 minutes. I think hopefully that should be enough. So when I was talking about conservation, there is the conservation of entropy. That's one thing that's conserved if you don't have viscous effects. There is something else that's also conserved if you don't have viscosity, at least for some sort of, not for all fluids, but for most relevant fluids that we're interested in. Let's see, can we get this down? It's already used. And this is known as vorticity, which is basically circulation in a fluid. I think I exhausted my because there's bite shock. So there is also vorticity conservation, which is at least for. So the statement is that if you have. Yes, vorticity, but there isn't any vorticity. Vorticity, which is, I guess, rotation. right. So The statement is that if you have inviscid, that means there is no viscosity. And barotropic or incompressible fluid. So you need to have two conditions. So inviscid, I just said if the eta should be small or zero, negligible. What is a barotropic fluid? Anybody knows? Not well. That sounds about right, but that I guess that would be the literal translation. But that's not what people call barotropic. Anybody? So the definition is if pressure is a function of density. Okay. So it doesn't have to be a function of density, but there are some situations that it is. For example, if you have constant entropy, then pressure goes as rho to the power of gamma, or if you have degenerate gas, you work that out, goes as rho to the 5/3 or 4/3. And in compressible, so there are different ways of defining it. Usually it means that the density is constant. So either of these two would do it. So the statement is that there is a quantity that's conserved. So let's see what that quantity is. Yes. Inviscid. So inviscid is just says that eta is zero. Viscosity is zero. Okay.
What about C and
right. So kappa doesn't enter here. And zeta, you mean there. So zeta, okay. I'm not 100% sure. That's right. Viscous force as is right. Is eta times Laplacian of V. Zeta, I don't think makes a difference, actually. Yeah, I don't think zeta makes a difference. It's just eta. And kappa and zeta don't make a difference for this. It's just eta. So the statement would be that, I'm not 100% sure. I think, okay, so maybe now I'm thinking about it, maybe zeta should be zero as well. So the statement is that now you start with these assumptions, you start from this equation. Right, I guess here we set zeta equal to zero. I'm not 100% sure whether that makes a difference. Okay. Now, this term, it turns out you can easily show, this, it can be written in this particular form. It's V dot grad V is 1/2 of grad V squared minus V cross curl of V. Okay. Now I can actually take the curl of both sides. So I get d by dt of curl of V. Curl of this guy, curl of gradients vanish. So I get minus curl of V cross curl of V. This guy, to see that this vanishes, I mean, these guys, these are gradients, their curl vanishes. This guy gives me 1 over rho squared, gradient of rho cross gradient of P. Right? So, and now you can see why this is zero if you have these conditions. If pressure is a function of density, these gradients are along the same direction, gradient of P and gradient of rho, so this vanishes. Or if you have incompressible gradients of rho, that vanishes altogether. So this thing is zero. And if I call this guy omega, this is vorticity. So omega is vorticity. Then I come up with the vorticity conservation equation, which is partial omega by partial t equals curl of v cross omega. So for example, what this tells you is that omega is, if omega is zero, it always remains zero. There is no vorticity, you can never generate it without viscosity. And in fact, so this I haven't, I'm not gonna show it, it's a little bit involved, I don't even remember how to do it, is that you can actually write an integral form for this, which it says d by dt of integral of omega dot a along some surface. If you imagine to have some surface, and you calculate the flux of this omega, and then time derivative of that across the surface. And this you could show from the Stokes law, that this is surface S, that this is d by dt of integral of v d dot dl. So this would be the boundary of the surface. So this is just basically the rotation of the fluid along the boundary. So this would be, I guess you can call this rotation. This is zero. If you move with the surface, so this is co-moving derivative. So the point is that basically if you look at the integral of v along a closed loop, which is the same as integral of omega dot this surface area, and if you move with this surface, this integral of v dot dl here and integral of v dot dl here, they are the same, they're equal to each other. So you move with the fluid. And the simplest case is that if this zero, it always remains zero. So without viscosity, you cannot, an irrotational flow always remains irrotational. And the only way to get rotation in a fluid is through viscosity or heat conductivity. So right. So the reason this thing is vanishes is if it's a curl. So if you integrate it along the surface, it's a little bit subtle. I actually don't remember how to do it, but so it needs to be co-moving derivative. But the point is that it's a curl. So if you integrate it along the surface, it vanishes.
So even if you try to stir a non-viscous fluid, you're going
to
get
right. Right, so you need viscosity for a steering to work. That's the point, right? Otherwise, it's going to be, well, it's hard because, viscosity is never exactly zero. You always have some small viscosity. And so that's usually enough, basically, for it to work. So the point is that if you want to generate rotation, say, the simplest case is that, I have like air here, and I'm gonna move this wall or this table.
Yeah.
So it's gonna generate some curl for velocity, right? Right, because viscosity. So then you cannot do it, basically, right? Right.
It shouldn't,
right. Unless there are some additional effect. The point is, I don't think it's ever exactly zero. So you just have to, right, right. So, in this case, if you start moving this table, there's always usually a boundary layer which starts moving, and then how long it takes for that boundary layer to basically start move everything else? That may take a long time, but eventually it will. But that's, I don't know in the case of liquid helium what happens. The one thing that does happen is that you can make vortices.
Vortices, and it would be functioning like current in a superconductor.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm not 100% clear what happens. I should look this up. No, so there's vortices in superconduct. Well, I mean, there's a magnetic fluxes, flux tubes in superconductors, and there are vortices in superfluids. And the point is that if you have a superfluid, the vortice never dissipates because of basically this. If you have an omega, you always will have an omega. All right. Yeah, so I don't know what is the right description of how you can generate rotation in superfluid. I imagine there is some effect, which is might be a quantum effect that does it. Yeah.
If there is already one present,
that's certainly one way to do it. Yeah. Okay, good. So this is important, and this is one thing to have in mind is that there is this thing that's conserved, and when I was talking about instability, is basically the point is that there is this is a neutral stability, but if you imagine so the derivative of this guy is zero, the instability of course doesn't make this this derivative would still be zero, but the point is that if you have a slightly disturbed flow, there are some modes that can grow and some modes that can decay. And the modes that can grow lead to instability. So this is similar to the entropy situation that I was talking about, that in the zero viscosity limit, this thing should be conserved. If you add, and this is, but then what happens is that there are some modes, that means that if you look at perturbations, some modes, not modes of this quantity, this mode is always conserved, but some modes of the velocity fields that could be unstable. Okay, so questions? So if you add viscosity, I mean, this thing can change, but also what happens generically, it decays over time. And so what happens is you start with vorticity. I mean, like if you stir the cough in your cup, eventually it's gonna stop, which is basically the corrections to this guy. I don't think I've written the corrections, but they always tend to decrease vorticity. Well, on average, they decrease the vorticity. Okay, so one last thing I wanted to talk about is sound waves. Let's see. And they are, of course, also very important. So sound waves are, first, I mean, how you're listening to me. the definition would be that, so they are kind of, they're opposite to vorticity. So these vorticity are things that are conserved, so they don't propagate, in at least in an inviscid fluid. So if you have vorticity somewhere, it's just going to sit there. I mean, it might move with the flow, but if the velocity, if the flow isn't moving, it just, I mean, the vortex is going to just sit there until it dissipates. The sound waves are opposite of that. So in some sense, these are the vector modes of perturbations. Perturbations of velocity that don't change density very much. But then you could have sound waves, which are perturbations of density. They're scalar versus vector modes. So sound waves are just by definition, you start from a uniform medium. At least the linear sound wave, you start from the uniform medium. So this is a constant. This could be a function of x and t, delta p and delta rho. So you perturb the fluid equations. The fluid equations, we had them in several places. I guess we had them up there. We had them here. So these were the fluid equations. And ignoring viscosity. So ignore viscosity. Viscosity. So we have partial delta rho by partial t plus rho naught divergence of delta v. All right, and then v would be just delta v because I start from rest. Is equal to zero. So I mean, so these are the linear equations. So these are small perturbations. So that, for example, there would be a term here which is delta v dot gradient of delta rho. This is second order. So I'm ignoring that. And then for Euler equation, you have d by dt of delta v plus gradient of delta p divided by rho naught equal to 0. And then here there would be, for example, a second order equation, which I'm ignoring here, second order term. This would be a v dot delta v, delta v dot grad delta v. This was this term, right? This term. If v is first order, this term is second order, so I'm ignoring that. So these are the linear equations for perturbations in a fluid. So I can now take the time derivative of the first equation, and then use the time derivative, use the second equation to plug into that. So I get d squared, the second derivative of delta rho by dt squared, plus rho naught. Rho naught is a constant. And I guess divergence of delta v by delta t, which I can plug in from here, minus, which is so divergence of minus gradient of delta p by rho naught equal to 0. So notice that rho naughts cancel. And if I assume that delta p, let me define Cs squared as delta p by delta rho, and assume it's constant. Assume. It doesn't have to be, but let's assume it's constant. For example, if you have a barotropic fluid, if p is a function of rho, then this would be just dp by d rho at that density. So this would be a constant. So then we find that you write delta p as C s squared times delta rho, and C s squared comes out. So you get basically delta rho double dot equals C s squared Laplacian of delta rho. Right. So this is a wave equation with the speed of C s squared, which is delta p by delta rho. Okay. For example, if you have an adiabatic gas where p goes as rho to the power of gamma, then you get, or a polytropic gas. So astronomers call this polytropic, adiabatic is one example, but as remembered, we discussed the degenerate gases. That's another example that you have this, this type. Then Cs squared would be gamma times p over rho. And which would be gamma times, say, temperature divided by mass of the particle. Gamma is just this it's just a number. Yeah, you have this property. So for an adiabatic gas, this would be 5/3, right? If it's monatomic adiabatic gas. I mean, this is a little bit misleading if you are, this was for an ideal gas, this you would get this relationship. Because P is rho kT divided by the mass, and if I just divide by rho, then I get gamma T times M. So C s squared, we know, for example, for ideal gas, it's just ideal gas is single atom. It's just 5/3 of thermal velocity, which is T over M, a square of thermal velocity. All right. So these are sound waves, and I mean, they're obviously something you've already seen. And if you haven't seen them, you have certainly heard them. So, and they tell you something important. They tell you how fast perturbations in density propagate. In particular, one thing is that if you have an incompressible fluid, if density is constant, then a sine speed goes to infinity. So these are usually used interchangeably. So these two, just from that equation, Cs going to infinity is the same as rho being constant. Right. Well, not necessarily a solid object. Water can be incompressible, right? So this says that basically you don't excite sound waves. So, I mean, this really what it means. I mean, of course, the question is, when I say it goes to infinity, in physical terms, it means that it should be bigger than something. And really what it means is CS is much bigger than the typical velocity of your fluid. And the statement is that if CS is much bigger than the typical velocity of your fluid, then the motion of the fluid doesn't excite sound waves, right? At least not significantly. And that means that you don't lose energy to sound waves, right? And in that regime, also density is almost constant. So these two are interchangeable, is the statement. So based on this, we could basically, let me just draw this last diagram. You could divide up fluids in a two-dimensional space. See whether I got something left here. Oh, good. This could be the last plot. So you have, remember, so we have, you see, we have two parameters that are important here, right? There is the ratio of velocity to speed of sound, whether you can excite sound waves or not, and we have the Reynolds number. And these are the most important parameters, at least for neutral fluids. If you have magnetized fluids, there are other things that come in as well. And that's also important in astrophysics. But at least for neutral fluids, you have this space of V over CS in one direction, and Reynolds number, which is rho VL divided by eta. And these distinguish different phenomena that could happen. So this would be, there is a special point, which is 1, where V over CS is order 1. And then the Reynolds number, I said somewhere around 1,000. Of course, that's kind of, it's not an exact line. Neither of these are exact lines. Sorry, it's 10 to the 3. So, and then we can just write down what happens in either of these regimes. So the simplest regime is if you have a small Reynolds number, a small velocity. So that's kind of the most well-behaved regime you can imagine, because that means you have large viscosity, so there's no instabilities that develop, and you have a small velocities, so that also means there's no stability that develop. So this is that laminar flows. So that basically, a small velocity, you see what it means is that sound waves are not excited, right? In compressed, that means sound waves are not excited. So these are not laminar flows, like what you may get in a tiny pipe, for example, or say in a straw when you're sipping water or soda. That's the kind of thing you get there. You have a small velocity. So Reynolds number is a small velocity, is much subsonic. So these are laminar flows. If the velocity becomes, if Reynolds number gets less than, bigger than 1,000, but velocity is still a subsonic, you have incompressible fluids. But you would get turbulence. This would be incompressible turbulence. And this is like river. So like e.g. river. So water in river or in the sea. So this is what you would get. So velocities are smaller than sound speed, but you do get heavy instabilities that lead to turbulence. So then in the velocity becomes much bigger than the speed of sound. That means you can excite sound waves. And we're going to discuss this next time. What can happen is you can form shock waves. Velocity is bigger than the speed of sound. So these are supersonic flows. Like you hear about airplanes, whether they are supersonic, they can actually, break the Mach barrier. So they make shock waves. We're going to discuss basically there's an instability. There's a different type of instability. This is not different from turbulence instability. And these basically generate discontinuities. So this is these are known as you call them collisionless shocks. So these are collisionless because what? Why do we call that? Why do I call it collisionless? Right. So Reynolds are small. That means that. Viscosity is big, which means that the collisions are small, right? Because remember, a small viscosity means lots of collisions. A small viscosity means no collisions. Sorry, big viscosity, no collisions, right? Shock waves, well, I mean, unless there's a way to derive them, like if you have like a supersonic jet, there is a velocity, like the boundary conditions give you a velocity. Yeah, if it left to their own, then they would dissipate. That's absolutely true. Yes, so they would dissipate unless, I think that's a good point. So dissipate unless driven. And like if you have a supersonic jet, continuously drives the shock. But the dissipation is very efficient because the shocks actually they generate entropy a lot because they have large gradients, they're discontinuities. And finally, there is this regime of supersonic turbulence where you have both shocks and turbulence at the same time, right? Right. So you have turbulence instabilities, and you can form shocks, and those are also interesting. Right. So generically, this is based on the terminology we introduced. These guys are called fluids. All of these guys are fluids, right? Because they have a large Reynolds number. These guys are collisionless because they have a small viscosity. Sorry, these guys have large viscosity. These guys, that means that collisions don't happen. And then, again, the same terminology. These guys, if they have large velocity compared to speed of sound, these are compressible. So that means that basically there is enough energy in the flow that could compress the system. Right. If you're down here, then you're incompressible. That means that basically the motion, there isn't enough energy in the motion of fluid to change the density significantly.
I don't understand why having a large viscosity is
good. So that was the main thing here, right? Remember, so if you have no collision, then lambda goes to infinity. Sigma goes to zero, lambda goes to infinity. Lambda goes to sigma goes to zero, lambda goes to infinity, then all of these guys blow up. So that's the thing that's counterintuitive, but that's kind of what we've justified all the way through, that if you want to have a small viscous effect that would be here, then you need very efficient collisions. If your collisions don't happen, then you don't have a fluid, basically. So you just have particles going their own individual ways. And so you shouldn't really think of these guys as a fluid, but rather you should just think of them as individual particles moving their own way. They have just a collection of particles. OK, good. Are there questions?
So in the blackboard,
underneath this?
Yeah.
OK.
So that equation there says that if I perturb density here, you will
propagate. Yeah, right. So this would, if you perturb density there here, it would propagate and with the speed of sound. But then, I think one physical implication is that if you have velocities that are much less than the speed of sound, you cannot perturb density very much. Yeah.
So I guess the, like, in a way, viscosity is that if you like have a perturbation, like the perturbation of the particles that you have perturbed will just move now with a bias.
Right.
And the other ones that you haven't perturbed won't ever gain that bias. And so you'll have I'm starting to understand why. That creates some sort of like viscous
You're asking why these are collisionless?
Yeah. Is that, okay. Hold on, no, I like mathematically, Yeah. It's just like in terms of how we colloquially talk about.
Yeah. No. So I think that the way we colloquially talk about things is can be I think misleading. So, right. So the collisions. So it's weird that you would think collisions cause viscosity, but in fact it's the other way around. That the limit of the more collisions you have, the less viscosity you get, because collisions isotropize the system. So that basically kind of it disconnects the different parts of the fluid from each other. That's what the collisions do. I think that this might be a little bit, I mean, you can imagine this is a cartoon, so there's aren't sharp boundaries really. I mean, like one thing is that you could have a regime between 1,000 and 1, but you still have a fluid description, but you still have laminar flow. So like that is possible. But basically the idea is the same, that if you go very down here, at some point the Reynolds number is over there 1, this is, in fact, I mean, you can plug in the numbers here, right? Eta is M times kappa, right? So this is rho VL. Eta is M times kappa, and kappa was V thermal divided by sigma. So let's see, and rho is N times M. So let's see what we get. So this sigma goes into the numerator, or N comes down here. This is just mean free path, masses cancel. So you get V times L divided by V thermal times lambda. Right. So if V is of order V thermal, so V thermal is also of order CS. I mean, you saw that was we had there. So this is roughly V over CS times L divided by lambda. So the idea would be, so these are not exactly the case, the same. So if V is of order CS, then when L becomes of order lambda, then you don't have a fluid anymore, because the size of the system is compared to the mean free path of the particles. But I guess what you can have is you could have V being much less than CS, and L being much bigger than lambda, so that in a way that this Reynolds number is still less than 1,000. So that could be a situation that's like down here. So yeah. And then you might have a fluid description, but it's still you still have a laminar flow. So there could be these combinations. But basically this is the idea, is that if V is of order CS and L becomes comparable to lambda, then Reynolds number is of order 1, and then you don't have a fluid description anymore. But there could be like other combinations where you have a fluid description, but you don't necessarily have, you also have a laminar flow as well. Okay? Good, thank you guys.